You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Now I'm a union man, amazed at what I am. I say what I think, that the company stinks. Yes, I'm a union man. When we meet in the local hall, I'll be voting with them all. With a hell of a shout, it's out, brothers, out. And the rise of the company's fall.
Oh, you don't get me, I'm part of the union. You don't get me, I'm part of the union. You don't get me, I'm part of the union. Till the day I die. Till the day I die.
Good morning.
Good morning, listeners, and good morning, members. Welcome to another edition of Fire Up Union Show. This is you're on 3CR. You're with David Ball, the Deputy Secretary of the Victorian Branch of the Maritime Union, and I'm here with Annie, our producer, and Aaron, my usual co-host. How are you going, Aaron?
Good, thanks, Dave. How are you?
Yeah, great, thanks, mate. It's been another couple of hectic weeks here in Melbourne, in Victoria, with the COVID situation is starting to get out of control again.
Well, thankfully, it's only isolated to a few suburbs, mate. So hopefully the bulk of Victoria can continue business as usual and we can stamp it out pretty quickly.
How's your fortnight been, Annie?
Oh, quiet, really. I mean, I thought it was all going to settle down and my daughter would come for dinner and all the rest of it. Now she's locked down because she's in one of the postcodes.
Oh, that's no good. Mm. We have a special guest here this fortnight, and that is the MUA's National Research Officer, and that is Penny Howard. How are you, Penny?
I'm good, thanks.
It's fantastic to have you on board. Penny works out of our Sydney office, or the National office. Penny has a really interesting role with the MUA, and it's one of those roles that many of our members may not be completely aware of what Penny does, and often unions come under criticism for not doing enough for their members and the membership not really understanding the role that some of our people play. And I, having only been an official for 12 months, I have to admit that I didn't realise how important Penny's role was and how big a job Penny's job is and the absolutely amazing work that she does. Penny, maybe you could give us a little rundown of what you do.
Well, thanks for that. Thanks for that glowing introduction, Dave. Much appreciated. Well, I mean, I work under the direction of the elected officials of the union. So that means I can assist with anything from the unions running a campaign at a particular company, doing background research on the company, and you know, what are the new projects that they might care about, how are they looking at their what kinds of things are they reporting to their shareholders which they might not be telling our membership, or telling the union. Often it's quite, they're, you know, they always have no money at all when they're talking to union members, and they're always doing great with heaps of money and heaps of new projects when they're making reports to their shareholders as well. And then on the government side, if the government's bringing in new legislation, I often get directed to go off, find out what it's all about. How does it affect MUA members, and what should our view of it be? What should we be doing about it? But also if there's campaigns, or political priorities that we have, trying to work out how best we can keep pushing those things forward. So our offshore wind campaign is an example of that. We've had to take the initiative around a lot of different things and try to actually work out what to do and what needs to be done, because there obviously has been a bit of a lack, a lack of the kind of government initiative that we need in that area as well.
So the offshore wind project, Penny, is one that I've been working with you, and I think one of the more exciting projects that the MUA is involved with. It's, you know, often we're being reactive or responsive to situations, but in this particular case, we're on the front foot and we're showing the initiative, and you, a lot of the work that you've done has been, you know, leading the industry, particularly, obviously in Australia in this area, because there is no offshore projects in Australia. Some of the hurdles that we've come across, Penny, include the total dysfunctional energy system that exists in Victoria, primarily as a result of privatisation. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so back in, I think it would have been the late 90s at some point, the governments all across Australia started taking apart their energy systems. When our electricity systems were built, they were built as one big system where you had integrated generation, transmission, and then the distribution to customers. And of course, with the big trend of, you know, privatization, neoliberalism, all that stuff in the 1990s, that all got broken into different parts and then broken down into different competing companies, and then through a market. So the concept is, you know, how can we help private industry make a profit off this essential service? And of course, when they brought in those rules, they actually signed, they brought in that system on the same year as they signed that Kyoto Accord about emissions reduction. But of course, they didn't include anything about the need to reduce emissions in these new rules and this whole fragmented new system, and we're living with the consequences now. So now we need to completely transform that system, but there's actually nobody in control of it. It's extremely difficult to do so when it's now chopped up into little bits and owned by different competing companies. And then, of course, on top of that, we've now got a government that just kind of denies that any of these things are problems that need addressing. So, of course, the people who lose out there are workers in the system, and of course also people using the electricity, because our electricity has just gotten more and more and more expensive through this whole process. And of course there's a few big winners, a few big companies that are, you know, making millions if not billions in profits, not paying too much in the way of taxes, and, you know, not making the kinds of changes that we all need.
Interestingly enough, the government is manoeuvring to support fossil fuel once again by, one, increasing electricity bill. There's going to be an increase in electricity costs for the consumer. That's in the pipeline. And I know that that's one of the methods that the government likes to use to push for the fact that we got to tie ourselves to fossil fuels. They manoeuvre in this direction. What's the union going to do to manoeuvre in a more positive direction?
Well, I mean, we've worked with the climate movement. We've worked with other unions like the Electrical Trades Union to advocate for better policy, and of course, we support the efforts by our comrades in the miners union, in our union, that we need a real plan for transition for, you know, all the coal-fired power stations as well. Because what's happening right now is, because there's no plan to transition them, as new renewable energy is built, it actually does undermine the operation of those coal-fired power stations. And then the private companies operating them can just, you know, make the decision almost overnight, like they did with Hazelwood, to shut them down if they reckon they're not profitable or they don't want to make the next round of investment on them. So that also, you know, really has a negative effect on the workers in those plants and in the communities around them as well. So, I mean, basically, we all need a plan for how this transition is going to be made, and a plan that supports workers in the system, the communities that they're a part of, and the users of electricity. You know, and you're absolutely right. The government says that you know, renewable energy is too expensive. We need cheap coal-fired power. We need dispatchable power. But really, when they look at point to those price increases are a result of privatization. They're not a result of renewable energy. But by the same token, when people say, oh, you know, if we introduce renewable energy, it'll be much cheaper. Unfortunately, that's not necessarily the case either, because it's all being introduced into a privatized system. So if we actually want to get the benefit of cheaper energy, it does need to be, there needs to be a lot more actual coordination, planning, and also public ownership of the system to make sure that the fact that we can generate cheaper electricity gets passed on to the people who are using it and doesn't just get squirreled away into more corporate profits as well.
If the government streamlined the process for the construction and development of an offshore wind energy, that would have a positive impact on prices, because there would be larger projects and therefore easier economies of scale in that sense. Is that right, Penny?
Yeah, I think so. Because right now it's just kind of a free-for-all. You know, the new renewable projects are being built just because, you know, a particular private company will say, oh, I reckon we should build one over here. But there's one of the crazy things about the way that this happens is that that of course all these projects need to connect to the transmission grid, and there's actually confidentiality clauses around different private developers knowing which other developers are trying to use that part of the grid and connect to that part of the grid. So it's really just a system of chaos, really, because people are competing to use the capacities of different parts of the transmission system without having the full knowledge of, you know, what the other projects are, what the full capacity is. Is there actually going to be room for this part of the grid to carry the transmission we need? And because it's all looked at in this fragmented way, people have a tendency to look at offshore wind and say, oh, okay, well, it costs too much. We can build turbines onshore for cheaper. But if you take a look at the whole system, because our industry is near the coast, because our population is near the coast, because offshore wind can provide much more stable and consistent energy. If you take a look at the whole picture of all the costs associated, then I think there's a very good case for building offshore wind in the ocean, you know, off the coast of Newcastle, of Sydney, off the coast of Gippsland, Melbourne, but also, you know, South Australia, Perth, the coast of Queensland are all areas that have been flagged up as where good places that where we could build offshore wind, and where there's already, you know, the electricity demand in the transmission grid right there that would be ready to connect to. And that's quite a bit different than, for example, a lot of the smaller projects being built inland. We've got, you know, projects all over Western Victoria, Broken Hill, different parts of, you know, rural Queensland as well. And there's just not the transmission grid there to support all the projects that are in the pipeline. And they're all much smaller as well. So, and that means you also need to have more batteries or have more hydro storage or that kind of thing to balance out all those different sources of demand as well. For MUA members, just a straight transition across to use the skills and the knowledge that people already have to build these turbines and in the process be part of a different industry, actually, to be part of producing electricity for the electricity grid. But offshore wind turbines could also be used to, for example, produce hydrogen that could get exported to other countries to use as a source of energy as well. So there's a few different ways that they can be used. But the first use is likely to be electricity for the energy grid, and that's why we've been working closely with the Electrical Trades Union on this. They're of course the experts on how that grid works, but also importantly, what are the problems with it and how does it need to get fixed? of course, our comrades in the construction division will be involved with building. There's a whole transmission cable to be built onshore to connect back up to Hazelwood. There's a lot of electricity work to be done by our comrades in the ETU. We want to try and get as much manufacturing as possible done in Australia. So that's why we've got the Manufacturing Workers Union involved and why they're supporting that as well. And of course, that's really important for Gippsland and the Latrobe Valley and, you know, all of Victoria as well. We want to make sure that our comrades in the Mining and Energy Division who are currently working in the coal-fired power stations, that they've got the opportunity to get to transition across and get jobs in these projects as well. And that's why we've called for a job guarantee too, that to ensure that workers in those industries have the opportunity to get a job on this project if that's something that they want to do as well. There's also the potential for some of the steel for these big turbines to come from Australian steelmakers too. So hopefully maybe BlueScope in Port Kembla could produce some of the steel for the foundations and maybe other parts of the turbines as well.
A bit of a slowdown in the oil and gas industry in a lot of areas, Penny, that's left a lot of infrastructure out in the middle of the ocean that is creating problems, for the environment, but it's also offering opportunities, and some of those opportunities are going to come to our members' ways, aren't they?
Yeah, well, the whole issue of the decommissioning of our offshore oil and gas infrastructure is going to just get bigger and bigger over the next few years. the infrastructure in the North Sea is older than what's been built in Australia, and they're right in the thick of that that debate right now. And the kind of calculations that have been done around jobs show that having a really good decommissioning standards with, importantly, standards for the use of local labor, of recycling the materials as well, and having that process done locally too is really important for to ensure that the offshore oil and gas workforce can transition and can remain employed and use their skills as well. So the current legislation in Australia is that basically you've got to remove everything, but there's no real trigger for when they have to remove it. So there's actually only been about three or four applications where companies have said, okay, here's our plan for what is going to be removed. The first plan that went in, the company went ahead and removed everything. The next three plans that have gone in have gone in from Woodside, and they've said, okay, we'll remove everything, but we'll keep the wellhead. It's a big metal structure that's right over the well. But just recently, Woodside's put in another application that says we want to keep the wellhead, and we want to keep a 23-kilometer pipeline, and we want to keep a 23-kilometer umbilical that's got electrical wires running through it, other hoses and pipes for hydraulic fluids and that kind of thing running through it. It's a total something like 400 tons of plastic. And their argument is that actually this is better for the environment because organisms and creatures have grown onto this structure. There's more fish, this kind of a thing. So if you remove it, then you remove the opportunity for that habitat. Now, it's just bloody self-serving nonsense. Plastics in the environment can create all sorts of problems. And just because there might be a few more fish there right now doesn't mean that as those plastics decompose, that they might affect, you know, the life cycle and reproduction of any of those organisms as well. And from a union perspective, that application that Woodside has put in, they also estimated it would be 7,000 work days to remove all of that material. Wow. So it's an interesting example where you've got a really clear overlap between, you know, these are jobs, this is work that needs to get done, that of course the union wants to make sure it's get done, but there's also a really good environmental argument of why that material needs to get used as well. Of course, it's not just Woodside. APEA, the big oil and gas lobby group, have flagged this as an issue. They've flagged it as an enormous problem that there's going to be something like $76 billion that will need to get spent to decommission different oil and gas work over the next few years. But their argument, of course, is that they want to lower the standards and leave more stuff in place and not have to spend that money.
It really is a complex issue, and it's going to need a lot of work in the future. Penny, we've run out of time. You've been a wonderful guest, and we'd love to have you back sometime because I know we've only scratched the surface with you. So thank you very much for your time today. It is a special day here in Victoria. It's our one-year anniversary as officials. So
It's also Penny's birthday.
Oh, it's Penny's birthday as well. Happy birthday, Penny.
Thank you very much. My son woke up this morning and said, "How old are you?" And I said, 43. And he said, "How do you even count that high?" So.
Okay, well, thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, everybody.
Come on, baby, let the good time roll. Come on, baby, let me thrill your soul. Come on, baby, let the good time roll.
very interesting how quickly they adopt socialist principles to protect a capitalist framework when it's not working. This has shown that they can chuck money and make a difference, and people are saying, well, make that difference now. We've got other emergencies. Let's spend some of that money seriously to reorientate the economy for public good and in the public interest, rather than saying, let the market provide. My hope is that they'll be bold with pressure to do things that build a more people-centred and focused future. And, you know, that comes down to us. It comes down to the 3CR listeners, the ACF and Friends of the Earth members, the trade unionists. It comes down to everybody that makes a difference and puts in. We need to build on the community that's been developed in the last couple of months and build on some of the smart ideas for a cleaner future.
3CR, your station in struggle and solidarity.
To donate, go to 3cr.org.au.
Listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.